So we're now starting to talk about a series of topics in Rav Lichtenstein's Hashkafa, his sort of core belief system, and probably the most central question that comes up outside of the questions of Torah study and secular studies that we've covered already is the one about ethics. Rav Lichtenstein writes about this in primarily in two places, and we're going to look at both of them. One lecture that was recorded and published in By His Light on being frum and being good, on the relation between religion and morality. That's based on a lecture he gave in 1986. And the other is his article, Does Jewish Tradition Recognize an Ethic Independent of Halacha?, which was published in 1975 based on a conference talk he gave in 1972. So those are his two primary writings on the topic. There's a couple other things we're not gonna look at, but we're gonna consider those today. And it's really a central question to Rav Lichtenstein. We touched on it a bit in the second class where we talked about the idea of integration, how everything connects, everything's part of his worldview, and ethics is a core aspect of that. So in the article on being frum and being good, there's really a few different issues that are treated there. First, the definition, what it means to be frum, what it means to be good. That's, I guess, less central for our purposes. But Rav Lichtenstein raises what's called the Euthyphro question. A classical debate that Socrates raises to another character in the story there, Euthyphro, about whether the gods love piety because it is pious, or is something pious because the gods love it. Meaning, what comes first, conceptually, right? Is something ethical because God says it's ethical? You can translate from gods that, for a polytheistic society, for us, we'll talk about one God. Is something ethical because God said so? Or did God say to do it because it's already ethical? What comes first? The question there really connects to two different ideas of God, of how God works. And Augustine plays this out as well. He quotes the pasuk, Ko Hashem ba'koach, Ko Hashem ba'hadar. God, the voice of God is in power, and the voice of God is in beauty, or you could even translate hadar as goodness. And that's part of the question, right? Do we follow God because God is sort of God's the most powerful being, God's the creator of the world, omnipotent, and that's why we follow God? Or, and maybe it's both, or it's because of something that's attractive about God, something the hadar, and what that would mean would be that's the ethical thing to do. And that's why we follow, let's say, Torah or whatever is commanded, because God told us to do it, and God told us to do it because it's the ethical, it's the moral thing to do. So Rav Lichtenstein takes a stand on this question, which has occupied philosophers for many years. He says that how could it possibly be that God's will is not moral and rational? That has to be the case, right? It's inconceivable that God would command us to do immoral things. So that's taken for granted. And at the same time, while we try to understand God, and there's a whole field of Tamei HaMitzvos where we try to understand each mitzvah and how it relates to morality, we're not necessarily going to get there. We're not going to always find the right reason. We're not going to necessarily discover why everything is moral. And at the end of the day, we may need to say, okay, I don't understand further, and I accept God, even though I understand God is moral, I'll accept God even if I don't see the morality. So at the end of the day, you have both aspects in some way, both God as a commander, which of course, as we saw when we talked about why to learn Gemara, is central, but also God as ethical and as commanding us to do things that are moral, that are grounded in goodness. So really, that means that the question of being frum and being good are very closely related to one another. There's a lot of overlap between the two, because by definition, as he understands it, if God commands it, it is good. So following God's word and being frum, by definition, means that you're being good in a sense. But then he talks about, what about people who have one and not the other? So people who, let's say they're very frum, but they're not really quite ethical, and vice versa. So for the former, someone who's frum but not ethical, so he quotes a Gemara, a very interesting line. Is there a righteous man who is good and a righteous man who is not good? Because the Imru Tzadik Ki Tov, the Pasuk says in Yeshayahu, say that the righteous person is good. So what does it mean? Isn't every righteous person good? And the Gemara answers that you have someone who's a righteous, you can have a righteous person who's not good if he's good to heaven, but not good to man, not good to his fellow person. And he talks about how there's this possibility of frumkeit, which is antithetical to and devoid of goodness. There's just You know, they keep all the mitzvos, but they just don't have that concern for others. And that's not talking about someone who's, let's say, evil or, you know, intentionally hurts other people. Hard to call that person a tzaddik or even a religious person, someone who's intentionally harming other people. But maybe someone who just doesn't quite care, who's a little apathetic about Bein Adam LaChaver. Or as he describes it, someone who pours his energies so much into Bein Adam LaMakom, between relating to God and those aspects, to such an extent that he has neither the energy, resources, nor motivation to work within the area of Bein Adam LaChaver as well. Right? You sort of run out of energy. All your religious energy is spent on serving God directly and, you know, being a good person, having a social conscience, being sensitive to the needs of others. You don't have room for that. You ran out of juice, so to speak. So that's someone, you know, technically the person's firm, the person's keeping the Torah in the technical sense, but something's very much lacking. There's a real hole in this person's spirituality because they're not a good person. They're not an ethical person. Even though they may check off all the boxes, there's something fundamentally missing. Yeah, so he says that explicitly. This person represents a partial and limited frumkeit, but a legitimate frumkeit. This is not to say that it is in any sense ideal, nor is it recommended. But if you tick off all the boxes, you did do that, right? You shook your lulav, and you even maybe gave tzedakah to someone, but you happen to just not care about other people. But you checked all the boxes. There's some validity to that. It's obviously not what we want from people. It's not an ideal in any sense, but there's some validity to that. And then he goes on to say the exact flip side, that someone... and I think this is, in a sense, a bigger chiddush, more of a novel point for some of the readership, that someone who's a good and ethical person, even if they don't keep Torah, that has to be valued as well. You can't say, well, you know, they don't believe in God, they're not a religious person, what value could their goodness be and their morality be? That's not the right approach to take. You have to accept, you know, the things that a person does as they do it, and... You know, keep in mind that there are multiple aspects to people. It's more complicated. This, in a sense, might be what this might tie in with what Professor Furziger called fragmentary Judaism, although I don't like the term. But the idea that you can appreciate one aspect of someone on both sides here, right? Just having the frum side of things and just having the good. This is not on the source sheet just yet. This is from the reading of being frum and being good. Rav Lichtenstein goes on to say that some people, you know, get very excited whenever they find out that people who are not Jewish or not religious are, you know, did something immoral, or there's, you know, high crime rates among people who are not Orthodox. They're like, oh, this is great. You know, we see how important it is to be Orthodox. If you're not Orthodox, you're a criminal and you're a bad person. And it's like, why would that make you happy? You know, like, these are either other people or other Jews. Why would you celebrate the fact that, you know, that society is declining, if that's the case? And you have to value all people, and we value in all people their goodness, even if it's only part of what we'd like to see, even if you'd want to see people both, you know, let's say Jews, both observant of halacha and of morality. If you have one, you need to take that for what it is and appreciate it. Then towards the end of the piece, he talks about some conflicts between religion and morality, which and instead of sort of wiping it away, wishing it away, and saying there's no such challenges, he's very honest in saying that sometimes there are things that if you develop your ethical self, you'll find in the Torah, seem to be challenging. And, you know, a good example of this is Amalek, right? Very timely, the mitzvah of wiping out Amalek, which seems odd. You know, generally we're not fans of genocide. It seems to run against our usual assumptions. But, you know, but it's in the Torah, so what do you do? So a person who doesn't really care and says, okay, genocide, that sounds fine to me, so you're not going to have any struggle. Right, whereas someone who does have that feeling, then there's a certain conflict, there's a certain tension here. And the attitude he says to take, and remember at the beginning of this piece he said that we don't always understand God's will, but we presume it's good. God is good. We don't always understand God's will, but we have to assume it's good. So the attitude he says to take is one of the Akedah. Just like Avram, when sacrificing or being about to sacrifice Yitzhak, wasn't just giving up his son, but was also, as Kierkegaard says, and he quotes him, was also sacrificing his morality, killing an innocent child. That Avram was willing to do it because he said, well, if God wants me to do this, presumably it's the right thing to do, even though I don't see it myself. But at the same time, Avram, according to the Medrash, spent 3 days struggling with himself, trying to understand why God could have commanded this, how this could be. So it seems from that Medrash like the ideal is, number one, to have those scruples, to really feel that, you know, something that seems immoral, to really feel that immorality of it, and yet also at the end of the day to follow God's will and do it, if God actually commands you to do it. Of course, in Avram's case, God retracted at the last minute, and maybe in a certain case, your understanding of halacha may be wrong, and you need to make sure you evaluate that properly. But if that actually is the case, that something you think is morally wrong is actually what the Torah and God is telling you to do, then you have to do it, but you should really feel like it's a challenge. And you know, that also entails a certain amount of risk, you know, meaning the more you feel that tension, the greater the chances are that you won't end up following halacha. You'll be drawn astray. But Rav Lichtenstein says it's so important to be moral and to develop a moral conscience and a moral personality that the risk in this case is worth it. And even though some people will go, you know, will leave observant Judaism and the like, it's so important to develop this sense that it's worth giving that up. You have a couple of hands? Yeah.
I think you sort of answered it, but does Ram view that struggle that he recommends as something, that's sort of like a primary thing that God wants us to do, or is it more that given that there are these misod that we find problematic, it's important that we react to them in this way? In theory, if we naturally found all the misod to be not problematic, would Rav Aaron want us to somehow be thinking along this anyway?
That's interesting. I don't think he directly relates to that. I mean, what he's definitely emphasizing here is it's important to develop a moral conscience, even things that are not explicitly in the Torah, just the right thing to do, and obviously that it's important to follow the Torah and accept the overriding, binding nature of the Torah. Whether it's better, you know, whether if there were a theoretical world where there was nothing that raised any moral scruples in the Torah, whether there would be a problem with that, he never says there would be. But I could say you might argue that there's some value to, you know, that's the Akedah, right? That's the idea of the Akedah, that Dafka do something even though it's difficult. So I don't know, it's a good question. I don't think he talks about that in the piece, but maybe worth exploring.
Yeah. Does he bring up on Avram's whole contention with God about Sodom?
He mentions that as well, yes. From, he quotes Benjamin Whichcote, one of the Cambridge Platonists, a chaver of Henry Moore. He quotes him. Yeah, but that's exactly the point, right? I mean, not most of us aren't on speaking terms with God, at least not in like a bilateral sort of way. But to the extent that you can raise those issues with God, and you should, because if it seems like it's morally wrong, how could you just, you know, go ahead with the plan and not question it? So yeah, I think that's a similar idea.
Not that God told Abraham because he knew that.
Right, that's one way of reading. I'm not sure if that's the Mahalach of Witchcote, but yeah, that he cites. So that's the being firm and being good chapter in By His Light. And that's, I guess, a simpler read, a much trickier read, and one that takes a slightly different angle, is the article, Does Jewish Tradition Recognize an Ethic Independent of Halacha? And in this, I guess there's really a couple of different pieces that Rav Lichtenstein discusses, but he starts off by talking about the question of whether there's a natural law, as it were, whether somehow nature includes within it like a natural set of natural set of precepts, what we should and what we shouldn't do. And he says, he quotes the Gemara, that if the Torah hadn't been given, we would have learned modesty from the cat, aversion to robbery from the ant, chastity from the dove, etc., that the world does have built into it some ethical ways of being, and derech eretz kadma la Torah, right? Ethical action, as he understands it here, comes before Torah. So there is this idea of natural law, but that's really irrelevant to the question of how we relate to it. Meaning, yes, there is morality one could discover from the world, but the question then becomes how we relate to that, given that we now have the Torah. So he says the question is whether, quite apart from the common from the ground common to natural and halachic morality, the demands of halacha are both so definitive and so comprehensive as to preclude the necessity for, and therefore in a sense the legitimacy of, any other ethic. Meaning, it could be that once you have Torah, that erases anything else, any other ethical system or any other ethical intuitions you would have had from nature. And that's the question in this piece that he ends up discussing most of the way, whether ethical intuitions that one has that are not explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch, let's say, whether those are binding or whether they're a part of Torah or not. Just before we go into the details, a little bit of background on the sheet. This first source here, David Schatz, who's a professor at Stern, just mentions in passing that this article, Rav Lichtenstein's article, Does Jewish Tradition Recognize an Ethic in the Pen of Halacha, is the single most cited article in modern Orthodox writings on how Halacha relates to ethics. So it's a very, it's a important article, not just in itself, but also for how discussions followed. And we'll hopefully have a couple of minutes to look at how other people have responded to the essay. Also, Stephen Schwarzschild, as early as 1976, just a year after the article was published, talks about how the article makes important points, and he already had read it and summarized it. So even like from very early on, it made a splash and is still discussed today, even in classrooms in Manhattan. That was this. So anyway, getting back to the article. So the question is given that the Torah has been given, that we receive the Torah, does that supersede and sort of erase and wash away any other ethical aspects that we might have learned from nature or not? Or is there some position for ethics, and how does it relate to Torah? And he says, to start off, we need to reject make two assumptions and reject two positions. One is that halacha is based in ethics. Halacha as a whole is pervaded by an ethical moment, and that's basically what we saw in the being firm and being good, right? That God and the Torah is ethical fundamentally. This rejects the position of Yeshaya Leibovich, which I believe we have here. If you jump ahead to source 9 on page 4, he writes, "The Torah does not recognize moral imperatives stemming from knowledge of natural reality or from awareness of man's duty to his fellow man. All that the Torah recognizes are mitzvot, divine imperatives. Ethics is the atheistic category par excellence." So this is an extreme, Yishai Leibovich. Torah is Torah. You keep it because it's Torah. It has absolutely nothing to do with ethics. God and the Torah commands are not moral in any meaningful sense. It may overlap with morality, but that's not why you follow it. You follow it because God said so, full stop. So Rav Lichtenstein says we have to reject this point outright. And number two, we can talk about that more in a bit. Number two, he needs to also reject the position that halacha is not binding. But he says we can only speak of a complement to halacha, not of an alternative. Halacha has to be binding, and we can't allow for antinomianism. And as you'll guess, several thinkers go in a different direction. For example, this will be source 5, Eugene Borowitz, a prominent Reform theologian. He basically says we have to reject halacha because, halacha is not quite ethical, and therefore you can't really keep halacha. Halacha is a nice thing you can keep if you want, but to say that halacha is binding is something that we need to reject. Right, a rabbinic Judaism must be seen as requiring less than what God now demands of the people of Israel. Right? We have an answer to a higher authority, namely ethics, rather than halacha. So Rav Lichtenstein rejects this as well, of course. Being Orthodox, that wouldn't quite work to be antinomian, to say halacha is not binding. And then the question becomes whether halacha is self-sufficient. So Rav Lichtenstein makes a very important distinction, building on the category of lifnim mishurat hadin. Lifnim mishurat hadin, often translated as going beyond the letter of the law, which is really a bad translation, but we can talk about that more another time. Literally, it should be with going within the line of law, meaning giving up something that you otherwise would have a right to do, and holding back from that. But Rav Lichtenstein discusses the difference between din, the halacha, the law as it is, and lifnim mishurat hadin, going, doing things that you wouldn't have to do just given the din, which again is why it gets translated as going beyond the letter of the law. And the reason why he does that, he says that if we equate halacha with the din, if we mean that everything can be looked up, every moral dilemma resolved by reference to code or canon, the notion that halacha is self-sufficient is both palpably naive and patently false. Meaning, if you say halacha has everything, we don't need any other system, we don't need any morals, and you say that we can look up everything that's halacha or din in the Shulchan Aruch, let's say, or in Rishon, or whatever it is, that's wrong and that's immoral. You end up missing out on very important things. As he continues, he says, "Which of us has not at times been made painfully aware of the ethical paucity of his legal resources? Who has not found that the fulfillment of explicit halachic duty could fall well short of exhausting clearly felt moral responsibility?" Meaning sometimes something feels morally binding and it's the right thing to do, and you can't find any Gemara or Rishon or Shulchan Aruch or halachic source that supports it. And it just clearly feels like the right thing to do. And how do you deal with that? You deal with that by saying that halacha is more than just a din. It's more than just a technical letter of the law that you can find in a book. You can find in the Shulchan Aruch. It's much broader than that. You need this idea of lifnim mishurat hadin, going beyond that point. And he builds on the Ramban. We have the Ramban here on the source sheet number 3. The Ramban and Kedoshim Tiyu, and there's several related Rambans, he says, Kedoshim Tiyu means hevu prushim, following the Medrash, that you should separate yourselves. And he says, what should you separate yourselves from? He goes against Rashi and says, really, what you should separate yourselves from, ein ha-prishun hazeh lefrosh min ha-arayo kedivrei harav, ala prishun him ha-muzkar b'chol ha-chol ha-talmud, she-be'alea nikrim prushim v'ayinyan, ki ha-torah is hira ba-arayot, and he goes on, I don't want to read too far, that the Torah is telling you to stay away, not from specific things, but from a life of excess. That if you follow the details of the halacha, or you check every box of what halacha tells you to do, you can still live a deeply immoral life. Right? You can have dozens of wives and sleep with them all day. You can just eat like a glutton, and there's no halacha against that. Maybe nowadays the wives cared being a gershom, but that's not the point, right? There's always loopholes. There's always ways around, and you can be a deeply immoral person while technically keeping the halacha, and that's not at all what the Torah wants. Instead, you have to separate yourself, meaning act ethically. And one of the examples of that he mentions towards the end of source 3 is this idea of the lifnim mishurat hadin, of holding yourself back beyond what your technical obligations are. And Rav Lichtenstein takes this point and really runs with it, really develops it. He quotes the Ramban at length, and he talks about what the basis of the obligation is. So for the Ramban, it comes from Kedoshim Tiyu, this idea of being holy, but it isn't technically counted as a mitzvah, but other people do. The Sefer Mitzvah Katan, the Smach, counts it as a mitzvah. Even though the Rambam doesn't count it as a mitzvah, he seems to think it's an act of piety to follow that. It still is something he clearly wants. As he puts it, even if you think it's not a duty, but an aspiration, it's something that one aspires to follow this idea of the Mishra Adin, a Jew is also commanded to aspire. So even if it's not obligatory, it's just something that's like an extra thing to do, you're, in a sense, obligated to go above and beyond. And then he talks about whether it's binding or not, or whether it's actionable, whether Bezdin, as it were, can collect, right? Let's say you're in a case where you do something that's considered not going the Fnimish Yerad Adin. You should really let your fellow person, use this thing of yours. You say, no, I don't want you to use it. Can Bezdin force you to act the Fnimish Yerad Adin or not? There's a whole dispute. The Rush says no. Some of the Tosafists say yes. But regardless of that question, it's clearly an internal halachic value that acting the Fnimish Yerad Adin is something that one should do, maybe even must do, and maybe even that the court forces you to do it. Yeah.
The way I've always understood that concept of acting with him as Shara's Adin or Kedoshim Tiyu isn't necessarily, the way I would have explained it wouldn't have necessarily been you're trying to do things that are immoral, like you're trying to follow up, but then you're also trying to be immoral. I would have explained it as trying to figure out basically trying to act in the spirit of the law.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that if we're saying that the law isn't necessarily connected to ethics, the spirit of the law is
So, right. So for Rav Lichtenstein, the law is connected to ethics, but it's not sufficient. And he gives two possibilities that I think tie in with your question. When, Lifnim Mishurat Hadin is supposed to do several things. It's supposed to fill in gaps where the halacha doesn't talk about something, but if you extend the halacha's logic or the halacha's broader goals, you would include that. Other times there are loopholes, right? You could, something is the right, is clearly the halacha, but there's a way to get around it. So Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, holding back from what you're technically allowed to do would say, don't take that loophole. So he says you could see that as part of the halachic system, or you could see this as technically not part of the halachic system, but as some extension. But either way, it's sort of a technicality, whether you say it's an add-on to the halachic system or it's an internal part. Either way, it's not in the books. It's something that's ethically clearly the right thing to do, and it should be seen as an extension of halacha, because there's this idea of lifnim mishurat hadin, which is based on halacha, even though you can't write down, the Ramban says that he's basing himself on, you can't write down every single thing that's the right thing to do, right? You can't say, oh, don't eat, 7,000 omelets in a day. Don't buy a $10,000 burger. To go in through every detail of what one should and shouldn't do, you're not going to be able to, you can't exhaust all the cases. So it gives you a broad ethical command, go lefnei mishurat hadin, do the right thing, and that relates both interpersonally and to how one conducts oneself. And that's the idea. That's what fills in the gaps. And that, so it's not outside of, you know, whether you technically say it's outside of Torah or part of Torah, part of halacha, it's clearly part of the broader framework. And that's actually essentially important because, we'll get to that in a moment. Let's just first define in somewhat of a sharp way, following Rav Lichtenstein, the difference between din and lefnei mishurat hadin. Din is the rules on the book. It's a body of statutes, things you can look up, halacha you can look up. And it's very specific. It's very specific as like a set of rules to apply. That's a din. You might call it law. The lefnei mishurat hadin is what he calls contextual morality, right? Morality based on the context, based on the scenario, which is both more general and more specific. Meaning, it's more general, like do the right thing, be ethical, help people. But it's also more specific because it applies differently in different scenarios. So, you know, sometimes someone's poor and you know, they're helping them out to save $2 is clearly the right thing to do. If someone is a millionaire, saving them $2 is sort of not really particularly meaningful, right? Whereas in a din context, like stealing $2 from someone is equally bad regardless of how much money they have, right? But like, but going above and beyond, as it were, would depend on the context as to whether it actually helps the person or not, whether it's meaningful or not. So that's the definition, the distinction between din and the lefnei mishurat hadin. And part of the reason why it's important to have the lefnei mishurat hadin be related, he writes, is that halachic commitment orients a Jew's whole being around his relation to God. Meaning, if you say the lefnei mishurat hadin is an extension of halacha, is part of halacha, so it's, whether you say that or not, it's part of your relationship with God, right? That God wants you to do the lefnei mishurat hadin, to not just technically follow halacha, but also to be an ethical and moral person and to act on that basis. And that basically integrates both din and lefnei mishurat hadin as part of one's religiosity and part of one's relating to God. So that's essentially the argument that lefnei mishurat hadin is binding. It covers ethics, and even things that are not on the books are binding as this, you know, super legal point. And in conclusion, Rav Lichtenstein writes that traditional halachic Judaism demands of the Jew both adherence to halacha and commitment to an ethical moment that, though different from halacha, is nevertheless of a piece with it and in its own way fully imperative. I mean, it's not technically halacha, it's sort of connected to it in some way, but it's definitely imperative. And he rejects emphatically the idea that you can define halacha in the technical sense, what's on the books, what's in the Shulchan Aruch, and also say that that's all you need to do. Right? If you say all you need to do is what's written in Shulchan Aruch and you have no other obligations, that's what he's strongly opposed to. You need to see ethics as also obligatory, whether you technically call that part of halacha or not. So that's the argument here, and we already mentioned a couple of reactions by people who reject the idea that halacha is ethical and by people who reject the idea that halacha is binding. Those are sort of the easy alternatives that people take. But you have somewhat more nuanced alternative positions in various ways. Some of the arguments are just that they think the lefnei mishurat hadin is not quite the way Rav Lichtenstein presents it. It's more narrow, or that it's not used by poskim in a systematic way. It's sort of harder to define, harder to see it as a core part of the system. Gerald Blitzstein makes a point in that direction. So that's, I guess, one objection. But there are a couple of other objections that are, I guess, more to the content. Rabbi Bleich has an article, Is There an Ethic Beyond Halacha? Obviously, in response to this article, published about 10 years later. And he says, well, you know, of course there's this idea of lefnei mishurat hadin, but, and Rabbi Bleich is a formalist, as you'll see, he basically says, yeah, lefnei mishurat hadin, if you look through all of rabbinic literature, everything that's on the books, there are 8 different scenarios that fall under lefnei mishurat hadin, but nothing else. Only if you can find me a source that says this is lefnei mishurat hadin, will I admit that it's that. So that doesn't tell you that this idea of contextual morality is something that's clearly right in context and clearly the ethical thing to do. That's not binding on a Jew. There's no basis for it being binding. It's just, you know, maybe it feels like a nice thing to do. Okay, so nothing wrong with you doing it, unless there happens to be. But it's in no way part of Torah or binding. He can find the exact 8 things that lefnei mishurat hadin entails. And in terms of Judaism recognizing subjective morality, so he quotes the Bar Tanura in source 10 here, that says that why do we have, it's the introduction to Avot, tractate Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, as it's called. Why is there a whole tractate on ethics? Why can't you just pick up your ethics from wherever? So it says, he says, the reason why we have it is lomer l'chashi amidot v'amusarim shevizu ha-mesechta lo badu otam chachmei ha-mishnah milibam ela af elu nemru b'sinai. These are said at Mount Sinai, right? Ethics, as some people call it, ethics from Sinai, right? That's Pirkei Avot. And there's no other way of getting at these ethics. He's mentions that all sorts of other chachmei umot ha-olam gam kim chivru svarim moshe badu milibam. All these philosophers came up with ethics books, source 10, that they just made up, and there's no basis to them. Don't study that, study Torah. That's where Reb Leif takes that approach, and he says there's no such thing as an ethic independent of halacha, of a rejective morality. If you study enough Torah, maybe you'll develop your own internal ethics, but the idea that there's ethics outside of halachic sources is incorrect. So, although he presents himself as largely agreeing with Rav Lichtenstein, I think they disagree on that very important point, which Rav Lichtenstein emphasized at the end. If you say that halacha is, the only thing that's binding is what you see, is what you can find on the books, there's a problem here, and that's precisely the position that Rabbi Bleich takes. So they seem to disagree. One other point, what Rav Lichtenstein doesn't relate to here directly, he related to a bit in the being firm and being good, is cases where there's a tension between halacha and ethics. So he doesn't relate to it in this article. We saw elsewhere he says that you just need to feel challenged, to feel the tension, but at the end of the day, to follow the halacha, even if you don't see the ethics in it. A student of Rav Lichtenstein, Moshe Halbertal, wrote a whole book in 1997, Ma'apichot Parshaniyot B'Hidavutan, about interpretive revolutions in rabbinic literature, where he basically makes the point that, I don't know if Rav Lichtenstein would agree with, but his way of dealing with this tension is by saying that sometimes Chazal, when they interpret Chumash, they have values as well, and they use those values as part of their goal of interpreting Chumash. And he makes the point that they're not external values, because if it all comes from God, and this is a point I think that he's building on Rav Lichtenstein, whether or not Rav Lichtenstein would actually agree, if Torah comes from God and ethics come from God, and we're supposed to see them as one system, so it's not like you're bringing in external ethics and modifying Torah, you're just using ethics that are internal, that are part of the system, that also come from God, and you use them to help understand, to help your interpretation of what the law, what the halacha could possibly be. So I think this is an extension of Rav Lichtenstein's view. Again, I'm not sure if he would agree. He certainly never made those exact points, but that's an extension of Rav Lichtenstein's view in that direction. I mentioned there were two primary articles by Rav Lichtenstein on ethics and halacha. There actually is a third article that's not technically about that, but does reflect on it. In the year 1972, Rav Lichtenstein published an article, Kofin al Midat Sidom, on the halachic category of Kofin al Midat Sidom. We force people not to do Midat Sidom, not to act in a Sidom-like way, which relates not to sodomy, as it's generally misunderstood, but relates to how one treats their fellow person. So just to mention, this was published in 1972, the same year that Does Judaism Recognize an Ethic Independent of Halacha was that lecture was given, also in 1972. So these are, and he talks about Kofin al Midat Sidom there. These are clearly related articles, though this one is much more technically halachic. And throughout the article, Rav Lichtenstein analyzes many different cases that come up in the Gemara and the Rishonim as Midat Sidom, as this Sidom way of relating to other people. The basic category is a case of Zen Hanev Zelo Chaser, where you have a case in a financial situation where it won't hurt me at all financially for someone else to use something of mine, and yet I object to it. And there's a lot of different opinions about where exactly to draw the line. At what point is it something that's a loss? How bad is it if I object? But it's also connected by the Mishnah, potentially, to this idea of Sheli Sheli V'Shelcha Shelcha. What's mine is mine, what's yours is yours, and don't expect me to help you out. So that ideology, that's prohibited. Not only is it prohibited, Kofin al Midat Sidom, the courts enforce it. They will make you allow the person to use it, at least in some scenarios. And Rav Lichtenstein, after analyzing the halacha of this, towards the end of the article, talks about some of the broader ramifications. So one question he asks is, why do we do this kofin, this kfiyah? Why do we force people to allow it, to allow them to help each other? So he says two options. One is that this is necessary for society. If I have a spare room, someone needs a room, it won't cost me anything, I have to let them stay, because that's just efficient for society. That's one option. But the other option is that it's educational. We force you to do it in order to help you realize and act upon the proper thing to do. The right thing to do is to help someone when they need something, when that won't cost you anything, certainly. And if you're not willing to do it, we're going to force you not because, you know, it's so necessary, maybe that's also the case, but primarily in order to educate you and to make you recognize that this is the right thing to do. And of course, that has ramifications for how you understand ownership, right? Like, think about it. In current American culture, I have a spare bedroom, and, you know, I don't know, I wash the sheets every week there anyway, and there's someone who's homeless. The idea that, you know, minimal cost, they'll come and stay in the room, that no one would assume that at all. And yet that, you know, maybe not that exact scenario, but similar scenarios are what halacha demands. So it really gives you a certain view of how ownership works, how property rights work, how society should run. And Rav Lichtenstein jumps in on this. He says, in the framework of halacha, ownership does not have such extensive scope as you might see in other systems, for the reason that the Rashbam mentioned. We do not accept the argument put forward by the owner of the roof that he can object and say, don't use my projection, don't use the shade from the roof, for what loss is caused by the owner of the roof. Right? If there's no loss to you, you have no right to object to someone benefiting from it. And continuing, jumping ahead, the simple truth may be told. Kofin al-Midat Sodom absolutely contradicts the prevailing notion that a person is the supreme ruler over his property, and that his assets are like clay in the hands of the potter, that as long as he does not cause others direct damage, he can do with his property what he pleases. Halacha is animated by a different spirit, right? It's opposed to this individualistic ideology, which he attributes to Hegel. Hegel comes up in this Halacha article, that sees the idea of ownership as an extension and realization of the free self and denies any limitation. So he takes a strong stance towards, I guess, some version of soft socialism, in a sense, right? Ideologically, I think, that doesn't necessarily mean that he agrees with a certain economic view, but the idea, the philosophical view that you don't have full control over things that you own is the strong position that's taken here. And the point here is that our main goal in life is not just to realize ourselves, and property doesn't follow that, but we have broader obligations. Our broader obligations in this case are to the welfare of others. And that comes first, beyond self-actualization. And that's why your property, you know, there's the expectation that you use your property to help someone, even though you own it, as long as it, at least in cases where it doesn't negatively affect you. And that, you know, this idea about the relationship between property rights, personal rights and property rights is, you know, this is an important perspective on it. Not just that there's a, you know, mitzvah to give tzedakah and to do chesed, but that even the very idea of ownership is different because of halacha's view. So this is an important piece of the puzzle. Again, he quotes this in passing in the Ethic Independent of Halacha article, but this is a way of showing how values, and right, it's not clearly halacha that you have to do it. It's not, you own it. So in a sense, he doesn't have a financial right to it, but he almost has a tzedakah right in a sense, or if he can use it without a cost, he has some other system of rights. You might call it lefnei mishurat hadin rights to using your things if it won't cost you, and that's part of the broader picture as well, of understanding Rav Lichtenstein's view of the relationship between ethics and halacha. Now, just it's worth noting that you know, the various articles that we looked at, the goal is to bridge the ethics and halacha gap, right, and have your cake and eat it too, in a sense, right, to incorporate as much as possible. Halacha is binding, and halacha is ethical. And the goal is to incorporate ethics in everywhere, even where it's not technically on the books. And as we've talked about a couple times already this semester, that fits very well with this idea of holistic integrity, of viewing everything coming from God as part of one broader system. And it's also worth noting that as was mentioned, this article, as Dr. Schatz said, the article was very influential in later literature, I think for several reasons. But one is that it really relates, it takes a strong stance, it relates to a lot of the relevant sources, and it presents it, and I think people build on that, either they argue or they follow it. But this question was just coming to the fore in the 70s. The questions of relations between ethics and law generally, 60s and 70s, and this applied to halacha, which I think it really staked out a position at the right time. So, to make a bit of a pun, does Jewish tradition recognize an ethic independent of halacha? Is the name of the article, and it would be hard to recognize this discourse about the relation between ethics and halacha independent of Rav Lichtenstein's contributions to it.